A second sense is access to information. I ask a penny for your thoughts. You reply by telling me the content of your daytimes secreted by your stomach, the current settings of your eyes, and the colors, shapes, and sounds in front of you. But you cannot tell me about the enzymes secreted by your stomach, the current settings of your heart and breathing rate, the computations in your brain, secreted by your stomach, the key retinas, the rules of syntax that order the words as you speak, or the sequence of muscle contractions that allow you to pick up a glass. That shows that the massive information processing in the nervous system falls into two pools. One pool, which includes the products of vision and the contents of short-term memory, can be accessed by the system's underlying verbal reports, rational thought, and deliberate decision-making. Can be accessed gut-level responses, the internal calculations behind vision, language, calculations behind vicious desires or memories, if there are any, cannot be accessed by those systems. Sometimes information can pass from the first pool to the second, or vice versa. When we first learn how to use a stick shift, every motion has to be thought out, but with practice has to be thought out. But with practice, second or vice versa, frustration and biofeedback, we can focus on a hidden sensation like our heartbeat. This sense of consciousness, of course, also embraces Freud's distinction between the conscious and the unconscious mind. As with self-knowledge, there is nothing miraculous or even mysterious about it. Indeed, there are obvious analogs in machines. My computer has access to information about whether the printer is working or not working. It is conscious of it in this particular sense, and can print out an error message, printer not responding. But it has no access to information about why the printer is not working. Printer does not include the information. The chip inside the printer, in contrast, does have from printer to computer sense. The sensors in different parts of the printer feed into the chip, and the chip can turn on a yellow light if the toner supply is low, and a red light if the paper is jammed. Finally, we come to the most interesting sense of all. Experience, phenomenal awareness, raw feels, first-person present tense, what it is like tense, what it is like experience, never know. Woody Allen's joke turned on the difference between this sense of consciousness and difference between this access to information by the deliberative language-using parts of the mind. In this sense, sentience is the one in which consciousness seems like a miracle. The remainder of the chapter is about consciousness in these last two senses. Information the different parts of the mind make available to one another. In this sense of the word, we understand consciousness. Interesting things can be said about how it is implemented in the brain, the role it plays in mental computation, the engineering specs it is designed to meet, and hence the evolutionary pressures that gave rise to it, and how those specs, sensory awareness, focal attention, emotional coloring, and the will. Finally, I will turn to the problem of sentience. Someday, probably sooner rather than later, we will have a fine understanding of what in the brain is responsible for consciousness in the sense of access to information. Francis Crick and Christoph Koch, for example, have set out straightforward criteria for what we should look for. Therefore, some of the neural bases of access consciousness can be found in whatever brain structures act differently when an animal is awake and when it is in a dreamless sleep or out cold. Also, we know that information about an object being perceived is scattered across many parts of the cerebral cortex. Therefore, information access requires a mechanism that binds together geographically separated data. Crick and Koch suggest that synchronization of neural firing might be one such mechanism, perhaps entrained by loops from the cortex. They also note that voluntary planned behavior requires activity in the frontal lobe. Therefore, access consciousness may be determined by the anatomy of the fiber tracts running from various parts of the brain to the frontal lobes. Whether or not they are right, they have shown that the problem can be addressed in the lab. Access consciousness is also right. They have shown carried out by the brain. When we are aware of a piece of information, many parts of the mass of information, we not only see a ruler in front of us, but can describe it, reach for it, deduce that it can prop up a window, or count its markings. As the philosopher Stephen Stick has put it, conscious information is inferentially promiscuous. It makes itself available to a large number of information processing agents rather than committing itself to one alone. Newell and Simon have made headway in understanding human problem-solving simply by asking a person to think aloud when working on a puzzle. They have nicely simulated the mental activity by asking a person to respond step for step with the person's report of what he is consciously thinking. Of the bulletin board, correction pressures that probably gave rise to it are also becoming clearer. The general principle is that any information processor must be given limited access to information because information has costs as well as benefits. One cost is space, the hardware to hold the information. The limitation is all too clear to microcomputer owners deciding whether to invest. The hardware to hold the computer comes with vast amounts of parallel hardware for storage. Theorists infer that the brain can store all contingencies in advance and that thought can be reduced to one-step pattern recognition. But the mathematical combinatorial explosion bring to mind the old slogan of MTV. Too much is never enough. For example, there are 30 to 35 possible moves at each point in a chess game, each of which can be followed by 30 to 35 responses, defining about 1,000 complete turns. A typical chess game lasts 40 turns. 120th power different chess games. There are about 10 to the 70th power particles in the visible universe. So no one can play chess by memorizing all the games and recognizing every sequence of moves. The same is true for sentences, stories, melodies, and so on. Of course, some combinations can be stored, but pretty soon either you run out of brain or you start to superimpose the patterns and get useless chimeras and blends. Processor needs rules or algorithms that operate on a subset of information at a time and calculate a set of information at a time. A second cost of information is time. Solving a problem in 100 years is, practically speaking, the same as not solving it at all. In fact, the requirements at all intelligent agent are even more stringent. Life is a series of deadlines. Perception and behavior take place in real time. And since computation itself takes time, information processing time part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Think about a hiker planning the quickest route back to camp before it gets dark and taking 20 minutes to plot out a path that saves her 10 minutes. A third cost is resources. Information processing requires out the battery life of a laptop computer by slowing down the processor and restricting its access on the processor and restricting its thinking, too, is expensive. The technique of functional imaging of brain activity, PET and MRI, depends on the fact that working brain tissue calls more blood its way and consumes more glucose. Any intelligent agent incarnated in matter, working in real time, and subject to the laws of thermodynamics must be restricted in its access to information. Only information relevant to the problem at hand should be allowed in. Information that is relative at one time for one purpose might be relevant at another time for another. Information that is always irrelevant to a kind of computation should be permanently peeled off from it. Information that is sometimes relevant and sometimes irrelevant should be accessible to a computation when it is relevant, insofar as that can be predicted in advance. This design specification explains why access consciousness exists in the human mind. So, consciousness in the sense of access is coming to be understood. Sentience and access may be two sides of a single coin. Our subjective experience is for our reasoning, speech, and action. We do not just experience a toothache, we complain about it and head to the dentist. Speech and action. Distinction between access and sentience by thinking up scenarios in which access could occur without sentience. An example of access without sentience might be found in the strange syndrome called blindsight. A large blind spot because of damage to his visual cortex, he will adamantly deny that he can see a thing there, but when forced to guess where an object is, he performs well above chance. One interpretation is that the blind sighter has access to the objects, but is not sentient of them. Whether or not this is correct, it shows that it is possible to conceive of a difference between access and sentience. Sentience without access might occur when you are engrossed in a conversation and suddenly realize that there is a jackhammer outside the window and that you have been hearing it, but the window and that you have been hearing it, but you are engrossed in a to the epiphany you were sentient of the noise but had no access to it. But Bloch admits that the exquisite trained and suspects that in reality access and sentience go together. So we may not need a separate theory of where sentience occurs in the brain, how it fits into mental computation, or why it evolved. It seems to be an extra quality of some kinds of theory of how the subjective qualities of sentience emerge out of mere information access. To complete the story, then, I must present a theory that addresses questions like these. If we could ever duplicate the information processing in the human mind as an enormous computer program, would a computer running the program be conscious? What if we took that program and trained a large number of would a computer run the data and act out the steps? Would there be one gigantic consciousness hovering over China, separate from the consciousness of the billion individuals? If they were implementing the brain state for agonizing pain, would there be some entity pain? Would there be some if every citizen was cheerful and lighthearted? Suppose the visual receiving area at the back of your brain, every citizen was cheerful, receiving input from the eyes. By every behavioral measure, you are blind. Is there a mute but fully aware visual consciousness sealed off in the back of your head? What if it was removed and kept alive in a dish? Might your experience of red be the same as my experience of green? Sure, you might label grass as green and tomatoes as red, just as I do, but perhaps you actually see the grass as having the color that I would describe if I were in your shoes. That is, could there be an android rigged up to act as intelligently and as emotionally as you and me, but in which there is no one home who is actually feeling or seeing anything? How do I know that you're not a zombie? Who is actually implicated in another collection of molecules, would it have my consciousness? If someone destroyed the original, but the duplicate continued to live my life and think my thoughts and feel my feelings, would I have been murdered? Was Captain Kirk snuffed out and replaced by a twin every time he stepped into the transporter room? What is it like to be a bat? Do beetles enjoy sex? Surgeons replace one of your neurons with a microchip that duplicates your neurons with functions. You feel and behave exactly as before. Then they replace a second one, and a third one, and so on, until more and more of your brain becomes silicon. Since each microchip does exactly what the neuron did, your behavior and memory never change. Is some other conscious entity moving in with you? Heck out of me. I have some prejudices, but no idea of how to begin to look for a defensible answer. And neither does anyone else. The computational theory of mind offers no insight. Neither does any finding in neuroscience, once you clear up the usual confusion of sentience with access and self-knowledge. How can a book called How the Mind Works evade the responsibility of explaining where sentience comes from? I could, I suppose, invoke the doctrine of logical positivism, which holds that if a statement cannot be verified, it is literally meaningless. The imponderables in my list ask about the quintessentially unverifiable. Or as philosophers call them, qualia, are a cognitive illusion. Once we have isolated the computational and neurological correlates of access consciousness, there is nothing left to explain. It's just Iran left to expect that sentience remains unexplained after all the manifestations of sentience have been accounted for. Just because the computations don't have anything sent, because the computations don't have anything sent explained, after all this remains unexplained, even after all the manifestations of wetness have been accounted for, because moving molecules aren't wet. Most people are uncomfortable with the argument, but it is not easy to find anything wrong with it. The philosopher Georges Rey once told me that he has no sentient experiences. He lost them after a bicycle accident when he was 15. Rey once told me that zombie. I assume he is speaking tongue-in-cheek, but of course I have no way of knowing. But of course his point. The qualia debunkers do have a point. At least for now, we have no scientific purchase, or we have no extra ingredient that gives rise to sentience. As far as scientific explanation goes, it might as well not exist. It gives rise to simply untestable. It's that testing them would make no difference to anything anyway. Our incomprehension of sentience does not impede our understanding of how the mind works in the least. Generally, the parts of a scientific problem fit together like a crossword puzzle. To reconstruct human evolution, we need physical anthropology to find the bones, archaeology to understand the tools, molecular biology to date the split from chimpanzees, and paleobotany to reconstruct the molecular biology. When any part of the puzzle is blank, such as a lack of chimpanzee fossils or an uncertainty whether the climate was wet or dry, the gap is sorely felt, and everyone waits impatiently for it to be filled. The gap is high above the causal chains of psychology and neuroscience. If we neuroscience the neurocomputational steps from perception through reasoning and emotion to behavior, the only thing left missing by the lack of a theory of sentience left missing by an understanding of sentience itself. But saying that we have no scientific explanation of sentience is not the scientific explanation of sentience is not the of sentience itself. I am as certain that I am sentient as I am certain of anything, and I bet you feel the same. Though I concede that my curiosity about sentience may never be satisfied, I refuse to believe that I am just confused when I think I am sentient at all. Dennett's analogy of unexplained wetness is not decisive. Wetness is itself a subjective feeling, so the observer's unexplained wetness. And we cannot banish sentience from our discourse or reduce it to information access, because reasoning depends on it. The concept of sentience underlies our certainty that torture is wrong and that disabling a robot is the destruction of property, but disabling a person is murder. It is the reason that the death of a loved one does not impart to us just self-pity at our loss, but the uncomprehending pain of knowing that the person's thoughts and pleasures have vanished forever. If you bear with me to the end of the book, you will learn my own hunch about the mystery of sentience. But the mystery remains a mystery, a topic not for science but for ethics, for late-night dorm room bull sessions, and, of course, for one other realm. And to rust is the place he lived in and the machines he used. Without use, they will disintegrate from the wind and the sand and the years that act upon them. All of Mr. Corey's machines, including the one made in his image, obsolete. In the Twilight Zone. Neural circuitry has evolved in many animals, but the common image of animals climbing up some image of ladder is wrong. The common view is that lower animals have a few fixed reflexes, and that in higher ones the reflexes can be associated with new stimuli, as in Pavlov's experiments, and the responses can be associated with rewards, as in gets better in still higher organisms, and eventually it is freed from bodily events and physical stimuli and responses, and can associate ideas directly to each other, reaching an apex in man. But the distribution of intelligence in real animals is nothing like this. The Tunisian desert ant leaves its nest, insect that has keeled over from the heat. When it finds one, it bites off a chunk, turns, and makes a beeline for the nest, a hole 1 millimeter in diameter as much as 50 meters away. How does it find its way back? The navigation depends on information gathered during the outward journey, not on sensing the nest like a beacon. If someone lifts the ant as it emerges from the nest and plunks it down some distance away, the ant wanders in random circles. If someone moves the nest and plunks it down to of the direction of its nest and respect to the abduction site, slightly overshoots the point where the nest should be, does a quick U-turn, and searches for the non-existent nest. This shows that the ant has somehow measured and turned, navigation called path integration or dead reckoning. Information processing in animals, discovered by the biologist Rudiger Wehner, is one of many that the psychologist Randy Gallistel used to try to get people to stop thinking about learning as the formation of associations. He explains the principle. The discrete equivalent in traditional marine navigation is to record the direction and speed of travel, the velocity, at intervals, multiply each recorded velocity by the interval since the previous recording, to get interval by interval display. Each recorded on the northeast course for half an hour puts the ship 2.5 nautical miles northeast of where 5 is. And sum the successive displacements, changes in position, to get the net change in position. Change in terms of the longitudinal and latitudinal displacements are the deduced reckoning of the ship's position. Audiences are incredulous. All that computation inside the little bitty pinhead of an ant? Actually, as computation goes, this is pretty simple stuff. You could build a device to do it for a few dollars out of little parts hanging on the pegboard at Radio Shack. But intuitions about the nervous system have been so impoverished by associationism that a psychologist would be accused of wild nervous system have been so impoverished by associationism brain. Could an ant really do calculus or even arithmetic? Not overtly, of course, but then neither do we when we exercise our own faculty of dead reckoning, our sense of direction. The path integration calculus pokes into our awareness, and the ant's, if it has any, Other animals execute even more complicated sequences of arithmetic, logic, and data storage and retrieval. Many migratory birds fly thousands of miles at night, maintaining their compass direction by looking at the constellation. As a Cub Scout, I was taught how to find the North Star, locate the tip of the handle of the Little Dipper, Birds are not born with this knowledge, because if it were innate, it would soon be obsolete. The Earth's axis of rotation, and hence the celestial pole, the point in the sky corresponding to north, wobbles in a 27,000-year cycle called the precession of the equinoxes. Birds have responded by evolving a special algorithm for learning where the celestial pole is in the night sky. It all happens while they are still in the nest and cannot fly. The nestlings gaze up at the night sky for hours, watching the slow rotation of the constellations. They find the point around which the stars appear to move, and record its position with respect to several nearby constellations, acquiring the information imparted to me by the Cub Scout manual. Or flying into the celestial pole the next spring to return north. Honeybees perform a dance that tells their hive mates the direction and distance of a food source with respect to the distance of a food source with respect to the. Honeybees have evolved a variety of calibrations and backup systems to deal with the engineering complexities of to deal with the engineering. The dancer uses an internal clock to compensate for the movement of the sun between the time she discovered the source and the time she discovered the source information. If it's cloudy, the other bees estimate the direction using the polarization of light in the sky. Documented by Carl von Frisch, James Gould, and others. And once thought that bees offered a good pedagogical opportunity to convey the sophistication of neural computation to our undergraduates. He devoted the first week of his entry-level course in cognitive science to some of the ingenious experiments. The next year, the lecture till the students complained that the course had become an introduction to bee cognition. There are dozens of comparable examples. Many species compute how much time to forage at each patch so as to optimize their rate of calories per energy expended in foraging. Some birds learn the ephemeris function, the path of the sun above the horizon over the course of the day and the year, necessary for navigating by the sun. The barn owl uses sub-millisecond discrepancies between the arrival times of a sound at its two ears to swoop down on a rustling mouse in pitch blackness. Caching species place nuts and seeds in unpredictable hiding places to foil thieves, but months later must recall them all. Even Pavlovian predictable hiding places to foil thieves, predictable hiding places to foil thieves, but must be not a general stickiness of coinciding stimuli and responses in the brain, but complex algorithms for multivariate non-stationary time series analysis, predicting when events will occur based on their history of occurrences. The moral of this animal show is that animals' brains are just as specialized and well-engineered as their bodies. The moral of the use information to solve the problems presented by its lifestyle. Such organisms' lifestyles differ, and since they are related to one another in a great bush, not a great chain, species cannot be ranked in IQ or by the percentage of human intelligence they have achieved. Whatever is special about the human mind cannot be just more, or better, or more flexible, or better, or more flexible. It's generic animal intelligence. Each animal has evolved information processing machinery to solve its problems, and we evolved machinery to solve ours. The sophisticated algorithms found in even the tiniest algorithms found to serve as yet another eye-opener. Joining the difficulty of building a robot, the circumscribed effects of brain death, eye-opener for the hidden complexity we should expect to find in the human mind. The brains of mammals, like the bodies of mammals, follow a common general plan. Many of the same cell types, chemicals, tissues, suborgans, way stations, and pathways are found throughout the class, and the major visible differences come from inflating or shrinking the parts. But under the microscope, differences appear. The number of cortical areas differs wide, but humans. Primates differ from other mammals in the number of visual areas, their connections, and their hookup to the motor and decision regions of the frontal lobes. When a species has a noteworthy talent, it is reflected in the decision regions of the naked eye. The takeover of monkeys' brains by visual areas, reflects, more accurately, allows, their aptitude for depth, color, motion, and visually guided grasping. Bats that rely on sonar have additional brain areas dedicated to their ultrasonic hearing, and desert mice that cache on sonar have a bit of the cognitive map, then closely related species that don't cache. Human brain, too, tells an evolutionary story. Even a quick side-by-side comparison shows that the primate brain must have been considerably re-engineered to end up as a human brain. Our brains are about three times too big for a generic monkey or ape of our as a human brain, by prolonging fetal brain growth for a year after birth. If our bodies after birth, during that period, we would be 10 feet tall and weigh half a ton. The major lobes and patches of the brain have been revamped as well. The olfactory bulbs, which underlie the sense of smell, have shriveled to a third of the expected primate size, already puny by mammalian standards, and the main cortical areas for vision and movement have shrunk proportionally as well. Within the visual system, the first stop for information, the primary visual cortex, takes up a smaller proportion of the whole brain, while the later areas for complex form processing expand, as do the temporoparietal areas that shunt visual information to the language and expand, especially for understanding speech, have grown, and the prefrontal lobes, the seat for thought and planning, have ballooned to twice what a primate our size should have. While the brains of monkeys and apes are subtly symmetrical, the human brain, especially in the areas devoted to language, is so lopsided that the two hemispheres can be distinguished by shape in the primate brain areas for new functions. Broca's area, involved in speech, is a homologue, evolutionary counterpart in monkeys, but they obviously don't use it for speech, and they don't even seem to use it to produce shrieks, barks, and other calls. It's interesting to find these differences, but the human brain could be radically different from an ape's brain, even if one looked like a It's interesting in the patterns of connections among neurons, just as the differences in content among just as the different programs, microchips, books, or video cassettes lie not in their gross shapes, but in the combinatorial arrangements of their tiny constituents. Virtually nothing is known about the functioning microcircuitry of the human brain because there is a shortage of volunteers willing to give If we could somehow read the code in the neural circuitry of growing humans and apes, we would surely find substantial differences. Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary defines our species as follows. Man. An animal so lost in rapturous contemplation of what he thinks he is as to overlook what he indubitably ought to be. His chief occupation is extermination of other animals and his own species, which, however, multiplies with such insistence. His chief occupation, Canada. Homo sapiens sapiens is indeed an unprecedented animal with many zoologically unique or extreme traits. Humans achieve their goals by complex chains of behavior. They plan the behavior using cognitive models of the causal structure of the world. These models in their lifetimes and communicate them through language, which allows the knowledge to accumulate within a group and over generations. And depend upon many kinds of tools. They exchange goods and favors over long periods of time. Labor is divided between the sexes. Humans form large, structured coalitions, especially among males, and coalitions wage war against each other. Humans use fire. Kinship systems are complex and vary with other aspects of their lifestyles. Mating relations are negotiated by kin, often by groups exchanging daughters. Rather than at certain points in a reproductive cycle. A few of these traits are found among some of the great apes, but to a much lesser degree, and most are not found at all. And humans have rediscovered traits that are rare among primates, but found in other animals. They are bipedal, they live longer than other apes, and bear helpless offspring who stay children, that is, sexually immature, for a substantial part of their lives. Hunting is important, and meat a large part of the diet. Males invest in their offspring. They tote children around, protect them against animals and other humans, and give them food. And, as the Devil's Dictionary points out, humans occupy every ecozone on Earth. Aside from the retooling of the skeleton that gives us upright body posture and precision our behavior and the mental programs that organize it. In the comic strip Calvin asks his tiger companion why people are never content with what they have. Hobbes replies, "Are you kidding? Your fingernails, are you kidding? No fangs, you can't see at night, your pink hides are ridiculous, your reflexes are nil, and you don't even have tails. Handicaps, humans control the fate of tigers rather than vice versa. Human evolution is the original revenge of the nerds." Perhaps recoiling from the image of the pasty-faced, pocket-protected, polyester-clad misfits, an evolution have looked far and wide for alternative theories. Human ingenuity has been explained away as a byproduct of courtship device like the peacock's tail, as a stretching of chimpanzee childhood, an escape hatch that saved the species from the evolutionary dead end of bearing fewer and fewer offspring. Even in theories that acknowledge that intelligence itself was selected for, the causes are badly underpowered in comparison with the effects. Problems like chipping tools out of stone, cracking open nuts and bones, throwing rotten animals, keeping track of toddlers, following herds to scavenge their dead, and maintaining social bonds in a large group. There are grains of truth in these accounts, but they lack the leverage of good reverse engineering. Natural selection for success in solving a particular problem tends to fashion an idiot savant like the dead-reckoning ants and stargazing birds. We need to know what the more general kinds of intelligence found in our species are good for. That requires a good description of the improbable feats the human mind diligence found in our species are good for. That description must come from the study of the modern mind, cognitive science, and begins. Enough to explain the evolution of a brain in a vat. A good theory has to connect all ages, both sexes, anatomy, diet, habitat, and social life. That is, it has to carry life, the ecological niche that humans entered. The only theory that has risen to this challenge comes from John Tooby and the challenge comes from John Tooby and the humans entered. Or begin by noting that species evolve at one another's expense. Milk and honey, the Big Rock Candy Mountain, and tangerine trees with marmalade skies. But real ecosystems are different. Except for fruits, which trick hungry animals into dispersing seeds, virtually every food is the body part of fruits, which organisms evolve defenses against being eaten, and would-be diners evolve being eaten, and would these defenses, prodding the would-be meals to evolve better defenses, and so on, in an evolutionary arms race. These weapons and defenses are genetically based and relatively fixed within the lifetime of the individual. Therefore, they change slowly. The balance between eater and eaten develops only over evolutionary time. Humans, Tooby and DeVore suggest, entered the cognitive niche. Remember the definition of intelligence, using knowledge of how things work to attain goals in the face of obstacles. By learning which manipulations achieve which goals, humans have mastered the art of the surprise attack. The manipulations can be novel because human knowledge is not just couched in concrete instructions like how to catch a rabbit. Humans analyze the world using intuitive theories of objects, forces, paths, places, manners, states, substances, hidden beliefs and desires. People compose new knowledge and plans by mental composing out combinatorial interactions among these laws in their mind's eye. Many theorists have wondered what illiterate foragers. The foragers would have better grounds for asking the question about modern couch potatoes. The farming trip that never ends, but without the space blankets, Swiss Army knives, and freeze-dried pasta al dente. Living by their wits, human groups develop sophisticated technologies and bodies of folk science. All human cultures that have words for the elements of space, time, motion, speed, mental states, They combine the words into grammatical sentences and use the underlying propositions to reason about invisible entities like diseases, meteorological forces, and absent animals. Mental maps represent the locations of thousands of noteworthy sites, and mental calendars represent nested cycles of weather, animal migrations, and the life histories of plants. The anthropologist Louis Liebenberg recounts a typical experience with the Mo trackers of the Central Kalahari Desert. Consequently, that the spoor leaving the sleeping place had been made early that morning and was therefore relatively fresh. The spoor then followed a straight course, indicating that the animal was on its way to a specific destination. After a while, one tracker started to investigate several sets of footprints in a particular area. He pointed out that these footprints all belonged to the same animal, but were made. Footprints in a particular area was the feeding ground of that particular wildebeest. Since it was by that time about midday, it could be expected that the wildebeest may be resting in the shade in the near vicinity. Foraging peoples manufacture cutters, pounders, containers, cordage, nets, baskets, levers, and spears, and other weapons. Their engineering is often ingenious, exploiting poisons, smokeouts, gill nets, baited lines, snares, corrals, weirs, camouflaged pits and cliff tops, blowguns, bows and arrows, and kites trailing sticky fishing lines made out of spider silk. The reward is an ability to crack the safes of many other living things, burrowing animals, plants' underground storage organs, nuts, seeds, bone marrow, tough-skinned animals and plants, birds, fish, shellfish, turtles, poisonous plants, detoxified by peeling, cooking, soaking, parboiling, fermenting, leaching, and other tricks of the kitchen magician. Quick animals, which can be ambushed, and large animals, which can be ambushed, and large animals, which and other tricks of the and dispatch with weapons. Ogden Nash wrote, "The hunter crouches in his blind, neath camouflage of every kind, and conjures up a quacking noise to lend a lure to his decoys. This grown-up man with pluck and luck is hoping to outwit a duck." And outwit it he does, hoping to organisms that can beef up their defenses only in subsequent ones. Many species can defenses rapidly enough, even over evolutionary time, to defend themselves against humans. That is why species drop like flies whenever humans first enter an ecosystem. It's not just the snail darters and snowy owls recently threatened by dams and loggers. It's not just the giant woolly rhinoceros or other fantastic Ice Age animal is that humans apparently extinguished them thousands of years ago. The cognitive niche embraces many of the zoologically unusual features of our species. Unusual feature and use is the application of knowledge about causes and effects among objects in the effort to bring about goals. Language, application of knowledge, which can not only be used but exchanged for other resources, and lowers its cost. Resources, and lowered from the hard-won wisdom, strokes of genius, and trial and error of others, rather than only from risky exploration and experimentation. Information can be shared at a negligible cost. If I give you a fish, I no longer possess the fish, but if I give you information on how to fish, I still possess the information myself. So an information-exploiting lifestyle goes well with living in groups and pooling expertise, that is, with culture. Cultures differ from one another because they pool bodies of expertise, that is, with culting expertise, that is, with culture. Knowledge and skills. That shifts the balance of payoffs for males toward investing payoffs for males toward investing time as an apprenticeship being over sexual access to females. And that in turn makes kinship a concern of both sexes and all ages. Human lives are long to repay the investment of a long apprenticeship. New habitats can be colonized because even habitats can be differ. They obey the laws of physics and biology that are already within humans' ken, and can be exploited and outsmarted. Obey the laws of physics. Keen ape first enter the cognitive niche. Why not a groundhog, or a catfish, or a tapeworm? It only happened once, so no one knows. But I would guess that our ancestors had four traits that made it especially easy and worth their while to evolve better powers of causal reasoning. First, primates are visual animals. To evolve better powers dedicated to sight. Stereoscopic vision, the use of differences in the vision, the two eyes to give a sense of depth, developed early in the primate lineage, allowing early nocturnal primates to move among treacherous nocturnal primates and to grab insects with their hands. Color vision accompanied the switch of the ancestors of monkeys and apes to the day shift and their new taste for fruits, which advertised their ripeness with gaudy hues. End of side 3. Please turn to side 4.